people.
The Desi Ranking Show on BCFM.
Tune in each and every Sunday between the hours of 10 and 12. In the meantime...
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show Friday Drive Time with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. It could contaminate the water table forever, and when they tried it in Blackpool, it caused earthquakes. The frackers are coming to Somerset. David Powell's here from Friends of the Earth to explain who's really behind this, whether there's any real consultation going on, and whether there's good enough reasons to pursue such a potentially dangerous technology. Plus, Bradley Manning is guilty of exposing war crimes. Edward Snowden's guilty too of exposing mass surveillance of hundreds of millions of innocent people. That's us. From spying on Nazi military communications during World War II to spying on us, we take a look at our own spy agency, GCHQ, in Cheltenham and its origins in the 1940s. Where did they go so wrong? But we start this week by looking at the trial of Bradley Manning and his the prosecution and his conviction on all but two charges. Now, Martin, just give us a little bit of background about Bradley Manning. Most people have heard of who he is, etc. But what was the import of what he did? What did he actually, you know, what was the implications of it?
Well, I mean, he showed that he embarrassed lots of governments all over the world by showing the sort of things they say in private which they don't really want people to hear. And also, of course, the original things he showed was the shooting from the Apache helicopter with the, you know, the US forces just casually killing civilians without a second thought.
But ultimately, this is secret information. If he leaks it, I mean, it's like in this country breaking the Official Secrets Act. But part of his job is to keep his mouth shut.
Well, yes, and but of course there is also a higher truth, a higher law.
Is there?
At Nuremberg, it was made absolutely clear that illegal orders are not to be obeyed. And if the government is carrying out illegal activities, you are absolutely within your rights to say so.
Okay. What about the relationship with this Edward Snowden case, though? Because the two are kind of similar, giving out information. Really, Edward Snowden is, rather than giving the fine detail, he's giving more of the sort of pattern of the way surveillance is operating with the National Security Agency and GCHQ, whereas Bradley Manning was giving some of the fine detail.
Well, yes, and I think we are both people have been incredibly brave and serious, and they've alerted us to what's going on, and we need to know. The governments are breaking the law all over the world, and we need to know about it.
On Newsnight this week, we heard from someone called Daniel Ellsberg. He was a whistleblower back in during the Vietnam War in the 1970s. Martin, tell us a little bit about him.
Yeah, well, he was a top Pentagon official. And he realised that the whole rationale behind the Vietnam War was basically fraudulent, and that people were not being told the truth about what the decisions that were being made. So he went to work every day and photocopied all of the relevant documents. This is back before the days of the internet, and then he published the internal documents of the US government about the Vietnam War, and it was one of the major factors that led to the ending of the war, because he exposed what they were up to.
Wasn't it called the Pentagon Papers? I remember. A bit of a thumbed paperback book, which was from the 1970s, which was really just printing out all the stuff that
he took papers home from work every night and photocopied them. So it took him a couple of years to get all the paperwork sorted out.
So let's have a listen now to Daniel Ellsberg's take on the Bradley Manning conviction.
The debate that is now taking place in the Congress, the 205 votes voting for the first time to rein in the NSA in a way that must be, would not be taking place if Edward Snowden had done anything differently from what he did do. He had to be out of the country, as he saw from the example of Bradley Manning, or he would be in a cell incommunicado and not part of that debate right now. As a matter of fact, we owe Mr. Snowden a great debt for starting the possibility of remaining a democracy and not becoming the police state of which we now have the infrastructure, the architecture, the archives. Well, I'm very encouraged by the fact that there is at last the discussion taking place in the Congress for the first time on the fact that the reforms instituted by the Church Committee have failed. The FISA Amendment Court has failed as a use of the judicial to rein in the abuses of the NSA. The intelligence committees have failed. And in fact, the idea that President Barack Obama has said that three branches of government have participated in this, when what you have are secret briefings of a gang of eight in the Congress, secret decisions on secret law by a secret court, the FISA Amendment Court, that constitutes oversight and separation of powers is simply absurd.
Daniel Ellsberg there speaking on Newsnight this week. Martin, the situation is that Daniel is now coming back. He's saying basically that these are unconstitutional activities that are going on in the US, but no one's doing anything about it. I mean, we heard earlier on here in Britain from the Serious Organised Crime Agency, another example of somebody that's supposed to have great public trust, but it seems can't be trusted. The same is true, it seems, with the National Security Agency. He even there talking about having all of the infrastructure necessary for a police state.
Well, yes, and the other thing that people need to understand, and I keep banging on about it on this programme, is that NATO intelligence services have got a track record as terrorists, not just as eavesdroppers, as terrorists. So we're talking about the bombing of Bologna Railway Station in 1980, Piazza Fontana in 1969 in Italy, the Brabant massacres in the 1980s in Belgium, the Dortmund Beer Hall massacre in South Germany, and various other actions in Turkey and elsewhere. NATO intelligence services are terrorists. It's not a conspiracy theory, it's historical fact. There have been parliamentary inquiries in Italy, Switzerland and Belgium, which all concluded the same things. NATO are terrorists.
What about the National Security Agency, though? Because they're not terrorists, are they? And neither, surely.
I mean, no, they're
doing,
people who are.
All they're doing is they are gathering information. GCHQ and the NSA, what do they actually do, these organisations?
Well, I mean, we don't really know, do we? Because they're secret. But, I mean, basically, what worries me, I'm more worried about the overall strategy and direction of Western intelligence services rather than the fact that they do eavesdrop on people. It doesn't surprise me that they eavesdrop on people. We pretty much, that's what they're there for. The question is, who is in control of these services and who gives them their orders? And I will repeat it again. It's not conspiracy theory. It's historical fact. NATO intelligence services, including MI6 and the CIA, are terrorists.
Well, one angle to all of this is both the NSA and GCHQ in Cheltenham are being encouraged to get income from other sources rather than the government. Now, back in 2001, it was, I think it was MI6 or MI5 up in London, held a conference for big companies, banks, oil companies, saying, how can we help you? We would like to sell services to you. Now, how does that square with a government spy agency that was, you know, originally Bletchley Park in World War II, gathering intelligence and decrypting information about what the Nazis were up to in the war?
Well, I think this whole privatised security industry is absolutely to be condemned. As I was saying earlier, Homeland Security in the US, which didn't exist 15 years ago, now employs a million people. There's a whole forest of initials. Everything is being outsourced, privatised. So, you know, the Kraft International employees that were photographed at Boston looks as if they were actually the bombers. We're not quite sure, but they were the ones with the backpacks.
This is interesting, isn't it? Because the so-called Syrian Intifada hacked into one of the major news networks in Canada's Twitter feed with a picture, actually, of this guy, one of these employees of Kraft, and it actually said, "Hey, bro, where did your backpack go?"
Yes, so the Syrian intelligence services are being intelligent and pointing out to the silly people in Britain and America, hey, look, this bombing in Boston, this is the guy that did it, and he's actually one of your privatised security people, isn't he? Those are the people who are the terrorists. And this is the problem with the private security industry. They are the terrorists.
So how have we got become from this heroic Bletchley Park in World War II, managing to decrypt Enigma codes and this kind of thing, to give the Allies, let them steal a march on a lot of the German, the Nazi tactics, and potentially in other parts of the world as well. So how have we become from that stage, where that was that wartime agency, Bletchley Park, now to this situation with GCHQ? And I'm waving in front of you today's Guardian exclusive inside GCHQ, how the US pays Britain's spy agency £100 million for a very special relationship. Now, that surely US taxpayers should not be funding our GCHQ.
Well, you know, the deal in the US is that their spy agencies are not supposed to spy on their own people, and our spy agencies are not spying on our own people. So GCHQ spies on Americans for the Americans, and then Menwith Hill spies on the British for the British. So in other words, that this has been the deal between the US and Britain, going echelon is the name of the infrastructure they were using. Basically, they get round the regulations in each country by having other countries do the spying for them. So, you know, GCHQ spies on the American public before the American government.
Isn't it just a fact that Duncan Campbell, when he wrote that book back in the 1980s, Britain is the unsinkable aircraft carrier. This £100 million is to pay for access. So the Americans got access to all of that secret intelligence that GCHQ... Effectively, it's becoming a wholly owned subsidiary of the National Security Agency, GCHQ.
Yes, indeed. I mean, in actual fact, having our own independent listening agencies and intelligence services, there's only one justification in my mind for having independent British intelligence services. It's to deal with the Americans. But, of course, that's not what generally goes on.
Now, Michael Foot, when he was Labour leader, he didn't get elected, but he certainly never was Prime Minister. But one of the things he was talking about was actually ending the special relationship between Britain and America and actually pulling out of NATO. So what does that tell us about the way foreign policy has gone over the last 60 years since the end of World War II? Because it doesn't look to me as if we really do have a properly independent signals intelligence gathering agency anymore at all. And obviously, to be an independent country, you've got to have that.
Yes, well, of course, France came out of the structure of NATO in the early 60s and refused to participate in it under General de Gaulle. That's because the Deuxième Bureau were convinced that the Americans were behind several assassination attempts on de Gaulle. Now, Britain basically has been pushed into the European Union by the Americans as a Trojan horse. And Britain, you know, I mean, Britain has always been essentially America's cat's paw for the last, you know, 50, 60 years. And that's why our boys are fighting and dying in Afghanistan for America.
And there obviously are lots of American bases here. We've talked to Lindis Percy in the past from the campaign for accountability of American bases. Is that part of it? I mean, is there any prospect that that actually these US bases won't remain
here
in Britain?
I'm 53, and I put it to you that there is no case whatsoever for having US bases on British soil anymore. Why are they there? Who are they protecting us from? Nobody. I mean, Al-Qaeda is, in fact, a franchise of the CIA MI6. I mean, as we're seeing clearly in Syria and Libya, Abdul Hakim Belhadj, who used to run the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, was in Turkey helping the MI6 to arm up the Syrian rebels. So, in other words, we've got what they're claiming to defend us from, Al-Qaeda, is their own creation, and that's the only enemy we've got. And in other words, I don't think there's any case... The US has got 100-and-some-odd bases around the world. For what? Why have they got 100-and-some-odd bases around the world? Why do they need bases? And they've got the whole of the world divvied up. CENTCOM deals with the Middle East. AFRICOM supposedly deals with Africa. EUROCOM deals with Europe. They basically got the idea that they've got the right to intervene anywhere on Earth. And I just say, well, hang on a minute. You've got your country over there on the other side of the Atlantic. Could you just go there and mind your own business, please?
Finally, on this subject, the Lords, good old House of Lords, we're talking about this week, GCHQ snooping. We hear first from the Lib Dem Lord Strasburger, and also then from the Tory Baroness Varsey on this very subject of, have GCHQ gone too far, gathering information, vast amounts of it, on millions, tens of millions, even hundreds of millions of innocent people.
We now know that GCHQ is routinely hoovering up and storing prodigious quantities of the internet communications of millions of innocent people, turning us all from citizens into suspects. As far as I'm aware, Parliament has not sanctioned this industrial-scale seizure of our private data by the state. Could the Minister please tell the House whether this blanket snooping on all of us is authorised by a Minister?
I do not accept the noble lord's question, or indeed points that he makes in his question. I can assure this House that we take the interception of communications incredibly seriously. For these actions to go ahead, we need a warrant from one of the most senior members of government, as well as detailed legal advice to support that.
Well, I don't know why I don't believe a word that Baroness Varsi says. She doesn't, just doesn't sound credible to me. But, I mean, what about the point there that the citizens are now become suspects? And it, none of this has been authorised by Parliament.
Well, that's right. I mean, they used to talk about having a warrant to tap a phone, and that's a very quaint sort of notion these days, that there's actually a physical bug put on a piece of wire. Now, of course, you've got computers which can go through everybody's communications, and they've got algorithms which can read through it and all the rest of it. I mean, it's all just moved on. I mean, everybody's private information is totally vulnerable.
Does that include things like passwords for your internet banking, this kind of thing? Yeah. I mean, If you've got £100,000 at the end of one of these internet banking accounts, surely NSA or GCHQ, in theory, could sell that to somebody who could just take your money.
Well, they could. I mean, ultimately, we always ask the question, who guards the guardians? I mean, you know, I accept that there's going to be some secret services probably going to need to exist, police forces are going to need to exist, but the question is, who's actually in charge of these organisations? And I come back to what I was saying earlier, it's not conspiracy theory, it's historical fact that NATO intelligence services have been involved in terrorism. I mean, top Turkish generals, for example, of the Ergokonen network, which was a similar sort of setup to Gladio inside Turkey, they've all been sent to prison. They are NATO generals. These chaps were all trained at Sandhurst. They are terrorists.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
Google has disabled Press TV's YouTube account. That's Google, which has prevented Press TV from accessing its YouTube page since last Thursday, causing a large number of viewers and subscribers to contact the channel to find out what has happened. Well, I've contacted Press TV, and they haven't emailed me back, not least as far as I know, because my email account, as well as many others on GreenNet, has been, in the entire service provider GreenNet, has been down for over 24 hours now, something like probably 27, 28. It was 10 o'clock yesterday. The entire thing was taken out by a cyber attack. So I'm not sure if I've got an email back from Press TV yet. But anyway, Martin, this is pretty serious, isn't it? Press TV was closed down by Ofcom a couple of years ago, not being able to be broadcast here in Britain on Freeview or on some of the major satellites that are looked over. Now they've actually stopped them having access to their YouTube account, so we can't get the English language news from Press TV in this country at all now.
Well, yes, and of course it may be that this is part of the preliminaries for a war with Iran later in this year or the beginning of next year. And of course, why don't they want us to hear what Press TV have got to say? And that's possibly because Press TV actually covers a lot of these stories, for example, about NATO intelligence services being terrorists, which aren't covered by the BBC and certainly aren't covered by Fox News. And the justification for cutting them off is that they're supposedly biased. And you say, they're biased, are they? Rupert Murdoch isn't biased, but Press TV is. It's a laugh. It's a joke.
Well, so let's bypass their little ban and have a listen to Press TV now from a slightly earlier recording. Just to put this in context, we're talking about we discussed last week the prison breaks in Iraq. Since then, over last weekend, there were also big prison breaks in Libya with many thousands of potential terrorists now have been let out of these jails. Imagine possibly to go and join in with the rebels in Syria, who aren't doing too well, Martin, are they?
Well, yes, we don't know exactly where these people are going to end up, but it's all not what it seems.
So let's have a listen now to Webster Tarpley, who's a fairly regular appears fairly regularly on Press TV, see what he has to say about this kind of Mediterranean mayhem.
United States, as a matter of policy, is positively committed to bringing first Libya and now Syria as well under the control of terrorist gangs, death squads, which the State Department itself describes as satellites, branches of Al-Qaeda terrorism. So we've now got the perspective of the Mediterranean becoming a terrorist lake between the terrorist bases in Libya, which are spreading out across the Sahara into Algeria, into Mali, into other nearby countries, and then the future terrorist regime that NATO and the United States are devoted to installing in Syria, from which, of course, then Al-Qaeda will reach out into Turkey and Jordan. So this is one of the most colossal hypocrisies of the age. And it also shows the absolute fanatical recklessness of the U.S. ruling class, because this is something that you can't get away with. It's just, it's beyond all belief.
I think we're going to have to make a regular thing of this now. Banned broadcasts from around the world. We had North Korea last week, and now Press TV, which has had their YouTube panel, blocked access to. But Martin, what about, what is he saying? What he's saying there about this terrorist lake of right the way from Mali now, right across to Syria, potential Al Qaeda zone.
Right. Well, we've got to. It's worth repeating it. I will repeat it. I've repeated it many times on this show. Al Qaeda was created by the Western intelligence services. As Robin Cook said when he was Foreign Secretary, Al-Qaeda just means the base, the database. It was originally a hard drive which was kept in a man in Jordan, which had a list of all of the terrorists from places like Libya and Iraq and elsewhere who went through the hands of Western intelligence services, trained by British and American special forces, and then sent to Afghanistan initially and then elsewhere. So Operation Cyclone was the biggest secret mission in history. In terms of money involved and the scale of it, and Operation Cyclone, MI6 was the lead agency on that, and it was actually to create an Islamic international brigade to fight in Afghanistan and elsewhere. So when people talk about Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda from the very beginning has been set up, orchestrated and directed by Western intelligence services, and it still is.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
More international news, and Lockerbie bomber was released by Britain because of a £400 million arms deal with Libya. Tony Blair discussed an air defence deal with the Libyan dictator. The Lockerbie bomber's release was linked to a £400 million arms deal with Libya, Martin. Secret documents revealed this week. They show reprehensible connections between the Labour government boosting business and freeing the man convicted of Britain's worst terrorist atrocity. An email sent by the then UK ambassador in Tripoli to former Premier Tony Blair explained how a prisoner transfer agreement will be signed once Libya fulfills its promise to buy an air defence system. Now, it's certainly not just the Telegraph that's reporting this. That particular one is from the Mail. The Guardian's reported it too. So,
let's just talk about this absolutely clearly. The reason why Megrahi was released is because his appeal was about to be heard, and when his appeal was heard, a Scottish senior police officer, an inspector, was going to testify at the appeal that he had information that the CIA had interfered with the crime scene, to wit, they had planted a circuit board on the crime scene in order to implicate the Libyans. Now, in other words, they had to release Megrahi because under Scottish law he was about to go to appeal, and this police inspector was about to testify that the CIA had set him up, and then of course he'd have to be released, and then of course the Scottish police have got to fly over to the Pentagon and say, right, General, you've been messing with our crime scene. That's why they had to release him. And whatever deals were being done between Blair and Libya are secondary. The real problem is that the whole setup of Libya as to blame for Lockerbie was actually a setup, and that was going to come out at Megrahi's appeal, and that is why they had to release him.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
Finally, more Israeli strikes likely. Syria moved missiles before the alleged Israeli strike, Haaretz says, the Israeli newspaper. This is really building on a report we had last week about these Dolphin-class Israeli submarines built by the Germans that are floating around in the Mediterranean, every now and again pop up, send a few missiles out and hit Syria, committing war crimes and destroying a load of anti-ship missiles. First of all, Martin, what about this news? What they're saying now, apparently, in Israel, is it looks like most of these missiles have been moved before this attack on Syria was done by the Israelis.
Well, yes. I mean, the important point for people to recognise here is that the Chinese and the Russians over the last 20 or 30 years have developed basically anti-aircraft carrier missiles. So the US has got about 37 aircraft carriers, way more than anybody else. The Chinese have got one, Russians have got two, we've got one but no aircraft. And of course, the Russians and the Chinese could try and keep up with the Americans by making aircraft carriers, but there's no point. You know, you'd never keep up. And even if you got 37 aircraft carriers, the Americans just make 67 and so on. So what they've developed is cheap, cheerful missiles that kill aircraft carriers. And of course, if we go to war with China and Russia over Syria, which we may do, the first thing that will happen is all 37 US aircraft carriers will be taken out by missiles.
The attack took place last month on a warehouse in the city of Latakia. U.S. officials have told the New York Times that the U.S. intelligence analysts have estimated that the Israeli aircraft struck the warehouse. Well, let's say aircraft. They're also saying it was probably actually submarines struck the warehouse from the east without actually breaching Syrian airspace. Well, of course, the other thing is, if it was a submarine that had done it, they wouldn't be breaching their airspace anyway. So they're saying that it's okay to attack something which is right on the border, so long as you're not actually coming in.
It's quite clear under international law, the Israelis have no right to bomb anything in Syria. Because the Syrians could say, right, you're bombing us, well, we're going to bomb you. And of course, if the British were involved, they could say, look, if, say, Britain was involved in a no-fly zone over Syria, it would be absolutely legitimate in international law for the Syrians to come here and plant bombs in our air bases. Absolutely. Wouldn't it? If we're going to bomb them, they're going to bomb us. People have got to realise, if you go to war, that is what you're going to do. And then you have, and no crying for mummies when you get there. And of course, when Putin put these missiles into Syria, which actually kill aircraft carriers, there's two US aircraft carriers in the eastern Mediterranean, they move them right to the western Mediterranean straight away. Because in actual fact, if it comes to war, the first thing that will happen, all of the Western Navy in the Gulf, for example, if they're going to come to war with Iran, the Iranians have got these missiles, they will simply sink all of the big capital ships. They're actually Second World War old technology. The new technology is the SS-300 and the Silkworm missile, which will kill aircraft carriers. And that means an aircraft carrier, nobody's going to get off an aircraft carrier if it sinks. It's like a floating town. Everybody's going to David Jones's locker.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Well, I did say finally, but there is one more story, and that's actually a local one, believe it or not. That's to do with Filton and the Ministry of Defence procurement there. This is an article in The Independent. Ministry of Defence shake-up in chaos over conflicts of interest. The government's heavily criticised plan to privatise the £14 billion defence agency that buys the armed forces tanks and missiles in a crisis, as well as all the companies bidding to run the organisation, have acute conflicts of interest. Apparently, Martin, even the Pentagon is looking at the Conservative government and the Defence Secretary Philip Hammond and saying, what the hell are you doing?
Well, I mean, the conflicts of interest in the arms industry beggar belief. I don't think there's any case whatsoever for the private manufacturer of weapons. None whatsoever. It should be run by the government.
But that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about a private company overseeing the procurement process. Well, and these people up in Filton no longer become being civil servants, but working for one of these private firms. One of them that's being considered is Serco, which has just been found to be falsifying records to do with private prisons and tagging people. And another one is BAE Systems, who have obviously a very, very strong commercial interest in some of the contracts which would be awarded by such an organisation.
Well, exactly. I mean, BAE Systems used to belong to the British government, because I think all weapons production should be nationalised. Simple as that. It shouldn't be making profit out of weaponry. It's totally immoral.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
Well, now I'm joined by David Powell, who's been sitting there patiently through our last few stories from Friends of the Earth. He's the Friends of the Earth campaigner on economics. Hi, David. Welcome to Drive Time. Now, first of all, fracking. This has become very big over the last couple of weeks because some of these contracts are being rolled out, particularly we've seen in Sussex. How far advanced is this here in the Mendips and here locally to Bristol?
So it's not as advanced in this area yet as it is down in Bulkham in West Sussex, the place you're alluding to. Bulkham is the real hotbed of this stuff right now, because it's where an exploratory drill is going in as we speak right now. It's where massive protests are happening down there. We've got loads of people from Somerset getting in buses today and going down there so that they can take part in this protest because of the significance of it. But make no mistake, you know, this is what the government wants to happen across the country. They want shale gas drilling, shale oil drilling. It's destructive, it's dirty, it's big, it's coming to the Mendips, unless the government hear that people won't stand for it. And it's really, really significant what's going on in Bulkham and the sheer amount of opposition to it.
Well, I'm going to beg to differ with you there, because we have a serious energy crisis and the government needs to find energy from somewhere. So let's go now back to the good old House of Lords, which is, well, since there's no House of Commons this week, we've got to listen to them. And this is the Lib Dem Lord Ezra, former chair of some very old-fashioned institution called the National Coal Board, who should know a few things about energy, and also Labour's Lord Dobbs.
That reserve electricity capacity could fall as low as 2% by the winter of 2015. This has been brought about by more capacity being closed or mothballed than new plant coming in. I would like to ask my noble friend whether a better balance could not have been achieved.
In the middle of last December, the lights virtually went out because there was absolutely no spare capacity at all. And if the weather had got a shade colder, the lights would have gone out. Isn't it time we made some clear decisions about our fuel supply in this country?
Well, I put that to you, David. We cannot afford to be in the situation as we were back in December last year, where the lights nearly went out in Britain.
So there's two... thanks for that, Tony. There's two really different things going on, so let's separate them out. The first is... how do we generate our power? How do we make sure the lights stay on? And the second is, where do we get the stuff from which we generate our power? Now, what we're talking about with shale drilling and fracking is getting more gas and oil from the UK. We're not talking about using any more in the UK. We're talking about where we get it from. So we still have to get the stuff from somewhere. The bigger picture, how do we stop the lights going off? Well, we have a massive amount of energy waste in this country. The amount of waste that we throw away is extraordinary. The cheapest power station is the one you don't have to build. And we live on a windy, rainy, watery island with colossal renewable potential.
I'm not throwing power away, as far as I know. I don't leave my central heating on when I'm out of the house, that sort of thing. So who is wasting energy?
Well, it's estimated that £1 out of every four that we spend heating our homes in the UK essentially goes out of the window, goes out of the roof, because compared to places like Germany and Holland, where they've been investing in energy efficiency and housing for years and years and years, our houses are incredibly leaky. You might know about the energy performance certificate. Anyone who's tried to sell a house will know about the different gradings from A down to G, I think it is, with A being the best. Most of our houses are band E, so most of our houses are not even in the middle of what you might count as energy efficiency. The point I'm making here is that where you generate your power is a much bigger decision than just saying we are going to tear open swathes of the countryside and frack it. What we need to look at is, how do we use energy as a country? What sort of energy system do we want to have? Are we going to make use of the free renewable resources we've got, or are we going to stick with fossil fuels and all the damage that will cause?
Now, many of us have seen on our TV screens the conflict going on down in Sussex. I mean, how have we come to this? I mean, surely these sorts of things go through some kind of consultation process. What can we do around here if we're worried about fracking in the Mendips?
Well, I guess I'll answer that in two bits. What's actually really telling about this process was that a couple of weeks ago, the consultation closed on the last bit of permission that the company had to get down there. 873 people objected. A couple of days later, the government said, no, it's okay, we've read all the consultation responses and we're fine, that there's no problem. What's happening is that the few things that you have to go through, you do have to apply for a drilling licence, you do need permission for what you're going to do with the waste that comes out of fracking. All of these things are essentially being ticked off. And the reason for that, which is the second part of my answer, is the government is, and I quote, the government would say it is irresponsible for it not to do everything it can to turn the UK into a shale gas fracking hotbed. The government wants this to happen. They're throwing massive tax breaks at the shale gas industry, or they want to. They're sweeping away consultation, and what they're basically doing is saying this is going to happen, and requiring companies to do the consultation with local people. And of course, surprise, surprise, the companies do the consultation. They might tidy up a few bits of the environmental impact, but basically the drilling goes ahead. This is about preserving the way that we've used energy for the last 100 years. It's about preserving big corporates running our energy supply, centralised oil and gas, which goes into a centralised grid and keeps people locked into high energy bills. We need a completely different way of running our energy system, but this sort of thing is taking us completely down the wrong path.
Okay, what about the earthquakes? Because this is one of the things that bothered me about the original test drillings up in Blackpool. This is no joke, is it? I mean, especially because of the kind of land there is up in the Mendips, we could get the same kind of thing happening there. Now, I thought that what they did is they tested tested it out in Blackpool. They found it caused earthquakes. They decided this was a crazy idea and they were not going to do it. But now it seems that was all in the past, a long time ago, a previous government, and we've got a new government. So how come that these earthquakes aren't a problem anymore?
Well, I guess slight correction, Tony. What actually happened was there were earthquakes up in Blackpool. They paused the idea of fracking while they had a look at it. It was revealed that the earthquakes were caused, earth tremors, to be fair, were caused by fracking. The government did loads of work, commissioned loads of research, and came back and said, we don't think that these tremors are going to be too bad when they happen. I think the Secretary of State said, I stand to be corrected on this, but I think he said, as long as it doesn't get over 3 on the Richter scale, then it's all right. So basically,
if it only produces a crack in the side of your house, that's okay.
Well, as long as it's, we can put up with a few tremors, is basically what they're saying. Again, the context is that it was always felt like something of a foregone conclusion. They would pause it so they would see what was going on. So yeah, fracking causes earth tremors. It's not surprising when you think about what's going on. It's probably worth spelling
that
out.
Explain that. Yeah.
So what you do is you find a place where you think there is gas or oil down in the ground. You have to drill down for something like between 1 and 4 kilometers down into the earth. You go straight down. When you get there, you then switch and you go rapidly sideways. And what you're doing then is creating essentially a hole through the rock. You then pump down up to 30 million litres of water, of which up to about 1% is hydrochloric acid and various other nasty things. So 16,000 gallons worth of hydrochloric acid going in. And the sheer force of that water, 24 Olympic-sized swimming pools worth, forces out the gas and the oil. It's not surprising that that sort of thing causes earth tremors. It's not particularly surprising that sort of thing is a massive concern to the water industry. Water UK, who represent the water industry, are not happy with the idea of fracking. The Chartered Institute of Water Management are not happy with the idea of fracking.
But those 30 million litres of water, I mean, that's quite a lot of water. Isn't this actually going to take water away from the domestic supply and actually force water bills up for us?
Well, it could very well do, yeah. So, yeah, it's a huge amount of water. It's as much as 200,000 people use in a day. It's how much each shale will use. And, yeah, the Water UK, who represent the water industry, have said that this cannot be allowed to happen because there's a real risk that it will start affecting people's drinking water.
Forget the water for a minute. What about the hydrochloric acid? Does that then come bubbling back up through our taps? I mean, I've seen one of these films from the US where you've actually got people setting light to the water as it's coming out of the taps. It's got some kind of... Can you maybe explain that? It seems to have some kind of explosive gas actually suspended in the water as it's coming out of your tap.
Well, what that is, that's methane, is what that is. So essentially, the gas that you are getting out is methane. That's what you're, which is a highly potent greenhouse gas, by the way. And what's been happening in America is because the sheer amount of stuff going in and because it's poorly regulated, a lot of that methane just leaks into groundwater. It doesn't leak in at the 2 kilometres down. It leaks in as it starts to come out. And everyone's seen the terrifying images of people being able to set their kitchen tap water on fire. And that's not propaganda. That really happens.
Well, I don't know if anyone's seen it, but they certainly may be soon in the Mendips.
Well, that's it. And if I was a brewer, Buckcombe Brewery or someone like that, if I was a local brewer or somebody who needed a lot of water or somebody who needed pure water, I'd be really worried about it. Well, I'd be kicking up
on,
in the way that
everybody
that
needs water, David. Everybody, yeah. Not just the brewers. The You were talking about how some of the big energy companies are involved in this. Now, this is a company called Quadrilla. I've not heard of them. You know, who are these guys who are behind it?
So Quadrilla were quite a small company, started up 5 to 10 years ago, something like that. They've not been around for a very long time. They're now a quarter owned by Centrica, who own British Gas. So they're the big guys here at the moment in the UK. But if you look at in America, where there's a huge amount more shale gas going on, you're talking about companies that are part owned by Rupert Murdoch, Genie Energy, who are doing a huge amount of stuff in the USA and Israel, 5% owned by Rupert Murdoch. You're talking about massive companies. The same people, basically, who have been generating oil and gas from the North Sea and various places for years. You get what we're tending to see is some very small companies starting up who are sniffing around to see if there's gas, and they're doing it because they realise if there is, they've got a very high chance of being bought out by one of these big corporations for quite a lot of money. But these are big companies doing it, is the point. What this isn't is local people taking control of their energy supply. It's the complete opposite.
Okay. At the moment, what we're seeing in Sussex and what we're likely to see in the Mendips is test drillings only.
Yes.
So we needn't be bothered. I mean, I imagine there'll be another wonderful round of consultation where everyone will be asked, is this a good thing? So it's test drillings. How close are those to actual fracking going on?
Oh, no, very, very close, Tony. So in Balcombe in Sussex, they've gone through the formalities of applying for the permit for what they do with the environmental waste, with all the sludge and the toxic stuff that comes back out of a fracking pipe. They've gone through that already. So that was essentially the battle. So they're doing the test drilling, not in some sort of, oh, let's just put down a marker. They're doing it to find out exactly what's under there. But if what's under there is what we think is under there, then they'll be fracking in no time at all. That's why this is such a hotbed issue.
So aren't these companies actually denying the water, basically polluting the aquifers and the water table for all of us? I mean, anybody that, for example, walks in up north, when we heard this about it with this MP talking about, oh, you could do fracking up north, there's no one really cares about the countryside up there. But I mean, it's basically denying our ability to take natural water from a natural stream. I mean, these companies are denying us our natural right to water as a human being, never mind through the water companies.
Well, yeah, and what's supposed to be happening, and that the government's response to this is really telling. So the government will say, it's all right, it'll all be properly regulated, and it's all right, Quadrilla or whatever company has to consult with a local water agency, it's all right, don't worry about it. Now, what we know about what the future for this country is going to hold, we don't know much, but we know that water is going to be at a premium. Or it already is, you know, but we know that this country is going to get hotter because of climate change. We know there's going to be more people living in it. We know that there's still 25% of our water goes away in leaks, which is a separate issue that we need to sort out. Water is not something that we can just throw around willy-nilly, and it certainly isn't something that can just be assumed to be used by big corporations to get out gas, to make a lot of money, which stops us moving to a much more sustainable path that's fit for the future.
But apparently those in charge, the powers that be, say it doesn't matter because it doesn't have to happen in Sussex or these expensive southern areas, Mendip, Somerset. We can just do it all up north.
That's fantastic.
There obviously are in beautiful rural areas where it's not just so much about the drilling and the fracking, which I think are exaggerated, but about the trucks and the delivery and the roads and the disturbance, and those are quite justified worries. But there are large and uninhabited and desolate areas, certainly up in the part of the northeast, where there's plenty of room for fracking.
To continued murmurings from peers, Lord Howell, who's the father-in-law of the Chancellor, George Osborne, ploughed on.
Well away from anybody's residence. Well away from anybody's residence, where it would conduct without any kind of threat to the rural environment. So would you agree that if there's a distinction should be made between one area and another, rather more than lumping them all together?
Alicia McCarthy there as part of Today in Parliament. Again, the Lords, just because the Commons are in their recess doesn't mean to say the Lords can't talk about such things, even if they do make massive gaps like that, David.
Yeah, well, even better than that was, I don't know if you heard this, Tony, but he clarified that he'd actually meant the Northwest the next day. So he came out, he said, I'm sorry, terribly sorry for any offence caused to the people of the Northeast. I meant the Northwest, sorry about that. And you couldn't make it up. And unfortunately, this is the way it is. Very revealing, I think. You know, don't like to go into conspiracy theories, but why not? This is George Osborne's father-in-law who's saying this stuff. Now, the way that this is thought about is something that if people have objections, let's essentially sort of deal with them, but this is still going to happen. So I think the government doesn't really care about whether or not this will happen. It probably cares a bit about how much people get upset about it. What George Osborne has said he's going to do is he's going to unleash, quote, generous tax breaks for fossil fuels in this country. He's going to subsidise fossil fuels more than he already does. He already subsidises North Sea oil and gas. He's now going to subsidise onshore oil and gas. And the biggest picture of all here that we haven't talked about yet at all is why this is so attractive to the government. It's not because it's going to keep energy bills down. No one really thinks that's going to happen. Studies for the government's energy department says chances are it won't do much for energy bills. Studies for Ofgem, the regulator, says chances are it won't do much for energy bills, because really the UK is still fairly small in the scheme of things. What it will do is it will have people doing stuff that the Chancellor can then tax, and the Chancellor can bring money in, and it'll look good for growth figures because there'll be lots of stuff going on, and the Chancellor can point to the way that he understands how an economy should work, which is full of fossil fuel taxation, and say, there we are, fantastic stuff. That's what's really going on here, and it's why the Treasury is so excited about it. And you can read it in their consultation documents. You know, they're quite
open about it. They say it'll bring in a substantial amount of revenue to the Exchequer. That's what's really going on here, and that's why all of these concerns are essentially water off the back.
Now, you won't be surprised to hear, I rather like your conspiracy theory, and I've got another one of my own, which is Lord Green. He's the Trade Minister. He's about to be replaced for all sorts of reasons. Not that these people get resign, they seem to be sort of slowly, quietly shuffled out. But Lord Green, he's one of the big backers of fracking. He's got some investments apparently in fracking industries, and he sees that there's no conflict of interest of him being a government minister at the same time. He, Martin, is the former chairman of HSBC. He was in charge of the HSBC bank all the time they were doing their money laundering in Mexico. These people don't really seem to be serious democratic politicians that are making these decisions about our energy policy. And if we go back a few years, you can look at some of the big energy companies like Standard Oil in the United States, who were basically setting up companies which were supposed to be competing with Standard Oil but secretly controlled by Standard Oil, and they would use those companies to spy on other energy companies. They also did this thing which is called vertical integration, where they secretly set up companies which buy up all different parts of the process, for example drilling, refining, petrol stations, distribution, railway companies that distribute the oil, and so they have a complete monopoly on the entire industry. So what are your thoughts about the, you know, the some of the, I suppose, geopolitics behind how fracking is coming to happen? Because it seems quite clear from what David's been saying and several news reports this week that the government is taking absolutely no notice of very important legitimate concerns of all sorts of organisations, that this is both poisonous and actually is going to kill the planet from all this extra use of fossil fuels.
Well, I mean, the geopolitics of energy are extremely sharp. I mean, it's not a free market by any stretch of the imagination. You know, the oil price is determined by things like who wins the Iraq war. It's not a textbook free market by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, you just reminded me that there's also a big investigation going on into price fixing for the last 10 years by the major oil companies to artificially keep the price of fuel up. Now, I wonder, is every single individual who's bought petrol at an inflated price over the last 10 years going to be able to sue those companies?
Well, I don't know about that. I think that because it is political decisions, energy is political. It's not really economic decisions. These are political decisions, and therefore we've got to make political decisions in a political way, transparently. And you know, we should be moving, as David is saying, to a low impact economy, where in actual fact most of our problems are that we consume too much energy and we waste too much of it. And if we actually and the technology of not doing that is fairly straightforward. We've just got to do it. Make up our minds and do it.
What about what we heard earlier on from Lord Ezra and Lord Dubs about the fact that it looks like we're living on the edge, basically, in our now privatised energy industry, where many of these high demand times of the year, towards Christmas, that kind of thing, we actually are on the brink of actually not being able to deliver the energy and the lights going out.
Well, that's just scaremongering. I mean, what we've got to do is reboot our whole economy to make it low impact, and then we wouldn't be... The lights wouldn't be going out, would they? And of course that's going to take a while, but then on the other hand we do actually need to spend money to reflate the economy, and we could spend money on getting energy efficiency right, couldn't we?
Well, I was over in Germany, lucky enough to go over there a couple of months ago to see how they do their energy system over there, and it puts us to absolute shame. I mean, Martin was just saying, you know, we know how to do this stuff. We could tomorrow, if we wanted, radically change the way we make energy in this country, and it would be a good investment for someone to go and do it, if the government, you know, would allow it to happen. All this stuff about the lights going out, let's be clear, we've still got enough spare capacity on our system. We still have the same amount that Germany has, and Germany doesn't get all up in arms about it.
Yeah, they were saying at Christmas time, at one of the peak last year, that there really was, they came very close. Lord Ezra, the former chair of the National Coal Board, we heard earlier on. I mean, are you saying that's just not the case?
No, I'm not saying it's not the case, but in general, I think Martin's point is, but there may be isolated times. Christmas is obviously a difficult time. There may be isolated times when we come close to the edge, but frankly, as Martin said, you know, we could do a hell of a lot more, excuse my French,
to get out of that position in the first place. That only happens if you've got what we've had for the last 15 years, which is big companies essentially having our energy industry over a barrel and not doing the investment and choosing to sweat their existing assets, keep hold of coal plants, keep hold of gas plants. Then, of course, surprise, surprise, when someone tries to make them close down, like Europe, they start saying, oh, well, not sure about that because the lights will go out. It's all about preserving the existing way of doing things. Germany does it completely differently. Germany, its central, its bank that it has over there called the KfW Bank, a massive investment bank, gives 1% loans to communities to go out and turn entire towns renewable. You've got whole towns. There's a town very near to Berlin who completely provide their energy for their own needs from renewable sources. That's a different way of running it. As Martin says, though, you need to actually be serious about it. And if all you're doing all the time is just running after the big companies, continuing to get oil and gas and not daring to think about how it can be different, then yeah, you are going to have, you know, panics caused and which you're held over a barrel.
Well, we're in a situation where we're addicted to oil, David, aren't we? Completely addicted. You know, it almost seems to me that the price of getting around is fixed on the idea that, well, we'll always make how much you're going to pay in petrol slightly cheaper than public transport. So if you want to go by train, you know, you're looking at how much it's going to cost, and it's always a little bit more expensive, at least if you're not booking ahead, a long time ahead. So the end is not in sight, isn't it? And that rather suits the energy companies, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And if you look at companies like BP and Shell, they do this thing where they look forward 20 or 30 years in the future, and they do these massive great forecasting exercises, and they conclude, surprise, surprise, that the world is still going to have a really high demand for coal and oil and gas. And, you know, they may be right, but the point is they would say that, wouldn't they? Because in their heads, they have business models that are entirely constructed around coal and oil and gas. So it's not particularly surprising that the people who are doing all the looking forward into the future are concluding that we shouldn't do too much of this scary renewable energy stuff because it will destruct.
Well, this also suits government, doesn't it, Martin? Because, of course, they're completely reliant on these the taxes that they put on the fuel at the pumps. So it seems that we're stuck in this circle, really, with the oil companies absolutely dominant and making sure that they maintain our dependence on their stuff. And the government afraid to pull away from that because they'll see revenues falling from the petrol pump taxes.
Well, yes, and if the oil companies in the 50s ripped out all of the tram system in San Francisco, and not in San Francisco, in Los Angeles. You've now got a huge kind of smog and traffic problem in Los Angeles, completely avoidable, but the oil companies use their muscle to get rid of the tram system which used to exist
there. Well, it didn't just happen in Los Angeles, it happened here in Bristol in the Second World War. I mean, they decided in the 30s they thought that trams weren't a good idea, and yet they managed to carry on most of the way through the Second World War. But actually they are, aren't they? And it seems that in their core again this week in the local paper, George Ferguson saying we've got to have the tram for that kind of thing in this city. David, bring things down to earth a little bit. What are the prospects for us actually moving away from coal dependence just here in Bristol? I mean, other cities have done it, places like Sheffield, Manchester, Nottingham, a few of them around the country, obviously some a little bit in London, in South London, for example. What about here?
Well, so there's two different contrasting examples, isn't there? So I lived in, I'm from London originally, and I lived there for a while, and I saw firsthand what happens when the mayor, Ken Livingstone, you know, decides that what he's going to do is massively increase public transport. And it really was remarkable what's happened to London transport over 10 years. And he did that by bringing in a congestion charge. But critically, what he, and people get very upset, you know, about congestion charging and the idea of having to pay more to drive, and I can understand that. But what Ken Livingstone did was he made the buses better first. He made the public transport cheaper, he made it available first, so that when people then were faced with congestion charging, there were good alternatives. In Manchester, they had the same idea, but they pitched it all in one go to the local electorate and asked them to vote on it. And of course, people didn't really want to go for it. They couldn't see the benefit, so they didn't go for it. I'm amazed, having come to Bristol relatively recently in my life, how expensive the buses are and how difficult it is to get around on public transport. The cycling is good, but the buses are extraordinary. And if you were to start bringing in congestion charging, which brings you a revenue stream so you can make the buses better,
then people aren't going to instantly go and fall in love with a bus because they're very expensive, hot things. What you need is the sort of powers in Bristol, in my opinion, that the mayor has in London, the sort of ability to borrow money, to spend, to be in control of the entire transport budget, and to borrow against it. Now, that's what Ken Livingstone did. If you do that, you can then guarantee a revenue stream in the future that you can use to improve your public transport now. But it means taking control of the bus companies. It means saying to the bus companies, this is how the bus service is going to run in this city, this is where it's going to go, this is how much it's going to cost, who wants to run it? That's what happened in London. That's what we need to see in other cities like Bristol.
But Martin, the bottom line is that what Davis, that wonderful new vista that Davis spelled out there, is a threat both to the massively powerful international oil industry and also to the government. It threatens their oil revenues, doesn't it?
Well, yes, I mean, I think we also really think outside the box. In places like Seattle, for example, buses are free. Everybody just hops on and off. And actually, that's a very efficient way to run things. So, but you really say to people, don't get in your car, just get on the free tram and go downtown. Easy. And of course, but we're not allowed to make money. If you're coming back to Ken Livingstone, his fares fair policy was overturned by the House of Lords because they argued that he had to run the buses at a profit, which was ludicrous. Nobody in the whole world runs a public transport system at a profit. And on that basis, the whole thing was struck down by the Lords. And this is just absurd. It's just and then, of course, the whole JLC was abolished to get rid of him. They knew that he would win any election that he stood in. So the London had no government at all for a period in order to get rid of him. And this is the establishment in this country, the oil, gas, military establishment, the House of Lords, all the rest of it, we are really living in the past, and we've got this huge resistance to modern thinking.
Okay, Canesham, Whitchurch, Saltford, Chew Magna, Pensford, Marksbury, Clutton, West Harptree, Tewton, Mendip, Midsummer Norton, Radstock, Shepton Mallet, Wells, Wookey, Pilton and Evercreech, all under threat from fracking, so we're keeping an eye on what happens in Sussex. Thanks very much, David Powell from Friends of the Earth. And also to our guest in the first hour, Labour Councillor for Hartcliffe, Derek Pickup. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. We're online at www.thisweek.org.uk.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, a children's charity says the fact a couple abused a boy for months before murdering him demonstrates a history of failures across several agencies. Daniel Pelker's mother and her partner have been sentenced to at least 30 years in prison. Before his death, the four-year-old's school contacted police and social services to voice concerns. John Cameron from the NSPCC says a serious case review will...